News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. A lot of you ask me about the title of the show, and every veteran who's ever been on this show says, I don't want to be known as a hero. We know that you're never looking for attention, but those of my generation want to honor you for your service and the sacrifices that you've made. And also there's this idea that no matter what your hometown is in this great country of ours, that there are some heroes in your hometown. There are some people around you that put their lives on the line for the freedom that we have. And in a lot of cases, there's also some history in your hometown. And if you're from the part of the San Joaquin Valley that I'm from, out on the west side in Las Banas, you may have run across a place called Eagle Field, kind of closer to Dos Palos, our old arch rivals in high school, but we like to claim it too. And Eagle Field is the location this weekend for a really neat gathering. It's a great piece of history right in our backyard. And my guest today is a gentleman who not only spent some time during World War II at Eagle Field, but is going to be there this evening as well. I want to bring in John Beta from Sacramento, California. John, am I right? You're going to be 90 this year?
90 in August.
All right.
1920.
Well, that's a big one to look forward to. And I know you enjoy your time out at Eagle Field, probably more today than you did during the war. But let me ask you, let's get started where I start with so many veterans. I'd like to take you back to a specific date that I think will mean something to you. And I know you're from Sacramento originally, and that's probably where you were on December 7th, 1941. Am I guessing correctly?
You're correct.
What do you remember about that day, and how did you find out that all of a sudden the United States was actually at war?
Yes, this buddy of mine, we lived in a private home where we roomed and board, and we had gone to Mass at the cathedral in Sacramento, and we were on our way home, and we... In those days, you know, the boys would run around with the extra, selling extra papers, and they said that Hawaii had just been bombed. That was, of course, on December the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on from there. We were kind of shocked. And immediately, the airport, they started putting up revetments, and within a day or two, they brought military aircraft in. I think it was the A-20s that they brought in. So things were really bustling about that time.
And you were at this point a long way from flying a B-25. We'll get to that later. But I understand you were one of those who was always fascinated with flight, building the model airplanes and all that. Had being a pilot been a dream of yours for a long time?
Had been. And I, as you say, I built model aircraft and bought paperbacks. So it was a dream for me.
So when you saw those military aircraft coming into the airfield near where you grew up, that kind of got your juices flowing a little bit, made you want to be in the Air Corps?
Sure did. It didn't take me long to think about enlisting.
How did that happen? Did you wait at least a couple days?
Well, no. A few days, found out that they had dropped the requirement for a bachelor's degree to get in the officer training program. So, of course, I immediately went out to Mather Field and took the written and a physical, and was interviewed by a flight surgeon at the end of the day. And, of course, he looked at me. He says, "It's a dirty shame you've passed everything, but you're too skinny." So I was disappointed, and he could see it. And he said, "I'll tell you what, you put on 5 pounds this next week, and we'll put you through on a waiver."
Boy,
and
what
was
a tough
I a happy
job.
Guy then.
What did you eat?
I went home, and he told me, of course, some milkshakes, and he said, just before you come out, drink as much water as you can, which I did. It was easy to put on 5 pounds in a week.
How much did you weigh at the time?
Oh, God, about 130 pounds or something like that.
Woo. So they needed you to bulk up so they could be sure that you were strong enough to operate this big, heavy, and expensive piece of equipment, right?
I guess so, but of course, we didn't know what we were going to get into at that point in time.
So how relieved were you when you saw what the scale said and they actually let you in?
I was so excited. I came home and immediately called my family, my mother in particular, told her that I had just enlisted in the Army Air Corps. And, of course, she kind of hesitated and said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And I said, "I hope they teach me how to fly." And, of course, her comment was, "Well, you don't even have an automobile. How are you going to fly?"
You're not allowed to drive, but up in the air, you're fine, huh? Well, and I understand that they did teach you how to fly. Was that something that was just fun all the way around, or were there some rough days where you thought, I don't know if I can quite hack this?
Well, actually, there were some tough times. You know, my initial flight, of course, went through pre-flight down to Santa Ana, but moved up to Dos Palos. Never been up airborne in an aircraft. And, of course, my first flight, I got airsick. I said, oh, my God, they're going to wash me out. We had civilian instructors at Dos Palos hired by the military to teach us how to fly.
Mm-hmm.
So my instructor immediately said, don't worry about it. He said, the next time I go out, we'll take it easy. And never got airsick after that. It was just, I think, it was something, excitement, and being airborne for the first time in my life.
Now, I imagine coming from Sacramento, you go down to Santa Ana, that's probably not too jarring. But then when you end up in Dos Palos, which I don't know if you'd ever heard of before, and this Eagle Field, which is kind of out in the middle of nowhere, I imagine that was a bit of a new experience for you. What do you remember about arriving there and getting a taste of what that atmosphere was going to be like?
We came up from Los Angeles. Of course, as I said, we went through pre-flight down at Santa Ana. Anyway, overnight on the train, they pulled up. It was daylight by the time we pulled in there and looked out, and all it was a platform with a little building on it. And I said, oh, my God, where have they put us? They bussed us out to Eagle Field. It was like a country club. Bowling alley, swimming pools, lawns. Instead of the usual barracks that we'd had down at Santa Ana, they were almost like motel units. They had a commissary and exchange. It was a beautiful setting.
So a bit of an oasis in the cotton fields.
Oh, it was an oasis out in the rice fields.
And what kind of training did you undergo there at Eagle Field?
We immediately, of course, half of the day spent at ground school and the other half on the flight line with your instructor. And then, of course, as you progressed, you had to be checked out within about 10 hours of flight time. If you didn't, they would wash you out and you'd go back through other training like a bombardier or a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
So usually 10 hours of flight training. And then after you had about 10 hours, they took a military pilot that was stationed there on base, would take you out for a checklight, see whether you're progressing properly. And you got 60 hours of flying time while you're there at Santa Ana, which was over a two-month period.
Now, I want to spend a lot of time on the 50 missions that you flew with the Air Apaches of the 345th Bomb Group, but maybe before we get to that, we can fast forward a little bit, because we just talked a little bit about your time at Eagle Field during the war, and I understand that long after the war, you attempted to get back and find Eagle Field and see if it was even still there. Can you share that experience with me?
Yes, the wife and I had been over to Monterey, and we'd spent a few days over there, and I thought, well, let's go home over 5, just take the San Luis Pass down into Los Manos. Then we headed south to find Dos Palos. Drove into town, stopped at a few places. Nobody knew what I was talking about. Finally, someone at a little fast food restaurant said, well, kind of gave me directions. And I went out there, and there was nothing but tumbleweeds. I could see a windsock out near the runway. And I found out that they were using it for pesticides,
the crop dusters,
Dusters, and also as a labor camp, they were using the accommodations that we had when we were there, and it was just devastated. I was just so disappointed, and I came home and thinking about it. Many years later, some young fellow from Chino called me up and said, John, we're going to have a fly-in up in your area. And I said, up here in Sacramento? He said, no, at Dos Palos. And I said, no way. Joe Davis had bought the property from the city of Dos Palos, and he was in the process of restoring it. So it was pretty austere that first year, but it's progressed tremendously since then.
And when you go back now and you see the hangar restored and you see the planes fly in and there'll be B-25s there this weekend, does it really take you back in time? Does it make you feel like you're in the 1940s again?
It's almost like a time warp. It's unbelievable. Anyway, it's I'm so pleased that Joe has had the time to restore this.
Well, and it really is a tremendous jewel right here in our valley that not too many people know about. And hopefully by us talking about it today, a few more people will find out about it and come out and join you and say hello to you. Now, we're going to take a break here, John, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to quiz you about some of those 50 missions that you flew. Get your close calls, your lighthearted moments, and all the stories that you have for us today. But for those of you at home, if you'd like to find out more about Eagle Field and when events are coming up there, you can go online. Eaglefield.net is the website. I've got a link to it on our website at kmjnow.com. We'll be back with more from 89-year-old John Beta, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
I know you all recognize that tune, Wild Blue Yonder. Very familiar to our guest today, John Beta. The song performed there by the local Sounds of Freedom Band. Had that great concert a couple weeks ago. Was so happy to see so many of you on Memorial Day at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium downtown. Don't forget to support that museum there, the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. Our guest today is a life member of a different museum up near his hometown of Sacramento that they have on the old grounds of McClellan Air Base, some pretty neat aircraft you can check out up there. And we're going to hear about a pretty special aircraft from a guy who flew it. John Beta, our guest today. He'll be 90 in August, but a big number for him is 25, as in B-25. And long before you flew missions in B-25s with the 345th Bomb Group, I guess you got to take one for a little test run halfway around the world, John?
Yes, they gave the crew and I a brand new B-25 that had just been assembled at the factory. It was flown there to Savannah, Georgia, by a WASP. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we spent a day or two calibrating instruments and running fuel consumption tests. They gave us our orders, flew from Savannah, Georgia, to Abilene, Texas overnight, and then into McClellan. And they added fuel tanks to the bomb bay and a bladder to the radio compartment because the wings didn't hold sufficient fuel.
Did you get to see your family at all while you were home?
What's that?
When you made it to McClellan, did you get to see your family or anything back in your hometown?
There was no family here. My mother was down south, and there really wasn't any family. I got to see some of the friends. It took about a month before they had everything completed, so I did some visiting while I was here in town. In fact, we didn't even stay at the base. We stayed at a hotel downtown. They finally transferred us over to Travis, which in those days they called it Suisun Fairfield. Mm-hmm. Left there about 2 o'clock in the morning. My navigator took some shots. And from there, we went on to Hawaii, did some dead reckoning, and then on down to Christmas Island, to Canton, to Tarawa, Guadalcanal, and then into New Guinea.
That's quite the tour.
It was, and we made a flight each day, fueled up, and took off early the next morning. But anyway, the story behind that is that once we got to NADZAB, they said, "Thank you. You've just delivered a plane to the replacement pool." My engineer was almost in tears because he'd babied that aircraft all the way across the Pacific, and it never had missed a beat. It was unbelievable how something would come out of the factory and fly halfway around the world, and it just never even snorted once.
And your whole crew was thinking you guys might get to hold on to that one and fly it yourselves?
We thought, of course, we were going to keep this nice brand-new aircraft. We were really disappointed. We were assigned to the bomb group, which was the 345th bomb group. And amazing, my instructor that I had back at Greenville, South Carolina, was a CO, and he saw our names on the replacement crews that were coming over. He said, "Do you want to come and fly with me?" And I said, "Of course." So we immediately loaded up on his aircraft, and he took us over to BIAC, which mm-hmm. was where the 345th Bomb Group was stationed. Anyway, it was really a surprising story to find him way out there in the Pacific. He was on his second tour of duty.
As big of a world it is, it can be a really small world at some interesting times.
Really could be.
Now, in that whole journey, and I like the fact that you mentioned the Wasps had delivered it to you, and a lot of people forget about that. There was the Congressional Gold Medal this year that I think brought much-deserved attention to the women Air Force service pilots. And at that time, when you guys took over the plane from them, was there any concern that that the women might have messed it up for you, or did you have every confidence in the world in their ability?
Well, we felt that they were doing such a great job. Of course, they didn't have anything with the manufacturing. They just carried it to where we were.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave us some insight as to whether the aircraft was functioning properly. So anyway, it was, and I felt very confident.
And when you talk about your crew, for our listeners who maybe haven't been on a B-25 or aren't as familiar with it, can you outline the crew on that plane, the different positions that there are, and what kind of relationship did you guys have as a crew?
Well, we were pretty close. Actually, the way I selected my crew back where we made up our crew, I got up and said, "Who's here from the West Coast?" And up popped five fellows, and I picked my co-pilot out. It was an officer, the navigator, bombardier, dual-rated. He was also an officer. And then I had an engineer, a radio man, and a tail gunner who were enlisted men.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew together for a couple of months back here on the East Coast. So we got to know each other pretty well, and it was just an excellent crew.
And how long were you able to keep that crew together?
Once you were assigned to a bomb group and to a squadron, you became a co-pilot for a few missions to kind of get your feet wet.
Right.
We flew some missions together, but then once I became a squadron flight leader and a squadron leader, and then I would lead the bomb group, they kind of mixed our crews up pretty much. So towards the end, I hardly ever flew with my crew, and my co-pilot, of course, was killed. He was flying with somebody else, and he had a wife and a child back here in the States. It was a terrible, terrible thing to go through.
And there isn't, as much as you know, stuff like that can happen. There isn't much that prepares you for that, is there?
There isn't. It's a shock. And every time we lost a crew member, we'd always have what they called a prayer meeting, and we'd give the flight surgeon would bring out the 190 proof alcohol that we kind of diluted, and we'd have what we called a prayer meeting, and those happened quite often because our squadron and the bomb group had a 50% fatality of air crews. We used our B-25s were actually strafers. They put 850s in the nose and two package guns on either side, so when I fired the guns, we were firing 12 guns, 12 50s at a time. So it just disintegrated everything out in front of you.
Absolutely. Now I want to ask you some more about some of those missions that you flew, but I'm curious, being in a B-25, and at this point, we're into what, mid-1944 when you're in BIAC?
Let's see. Actually, I joined the group in the fall of 44. I got my wings in commission in January of 1944. So by the time I got back east, out here to have the plane modified and everything, I joined the group in, I think it was about November of 1944.
Well, I bring that up because that's a pretty good chunk of time after the famous attack, the raid on Tokyo off of the Hornet with Doolittle's Raiders, who, of course, had a reunion using Eagle Field just about a decade ago. And you're back at that scene this weekend. But being in a B-25 in 1944, did that mean something to you because of the history that had been made earlier in the war and the excitement that was generated by that incredible action that General Doolittle led?
It sure did. In fact, on my flight to Hawaii, as I circled the area to make the pattern into the airfield, I couldn't believe it. I looked down. There were ships laying on their side. You could see where they had patched the runways. It was just nothing but devastation over there. And, of course, on the islands that I landed on to get to the BIAC, Tarawa was one of the worst ones. I couldn't believe the devastation on Tarawa. The Marines had taken a beating there. there wasn't anything on that island except stumps and some concrete, revetments that the Japanese had.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a shock.
So you saw the aftermath just about everywhere you went.
Yep, it was terrible.
Did that at all discourage you from the task that you knew was ahead for you? Did that make it harder?
It made it more. The determination was there to do what I could.
And I know you did that. I'll tell you what, John, we're going to take another brief break. Then we come back. We're going to talk about these missions. I'm going to ask you about your first mission and any of the 50 that stand out and what it meant to you to get home after it was all over. All those topics to come with John Beta, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A fascinating guest today, John Beta. He'll be 90 years old in August, but during World War II, a big number for him was 25, as in B-25, the plane that he flew 50 missions in with the 345th Bomb Group, the Air Apaches in the South Pacific. We're going to talk about some of that now. And, John, every pilot remembers his first mission. I know you were just the co-pilot for a few because they had to get your feet wet over there. But do you remember what that was like the first time you actually got up in a B-25 on a mission that really mattered?
Well, things happened pretty rapidly. You know, we would apply full power on these missions. They were strafing missions. And, we began shooting. They actually shot at us first, at us, and and then we reciprocated. But when we got back, we had a few holes in the tail and in the wings, but nothing serious.
Did that get your attention at all? Seeing some holes in the aircraft?
It was exciting to see that happen. But when you're on a mission like that, things are happening so fast you don't have time to worry about it.
And before long, you would get to fly some missions with your own crew, and you're the pilot, and there would be some pretty sticky situations that you were faced with. I'm sure there were times where your plane got more than a few holes and wasn't quite flying the way it was supposed to. What's the most egregious example, if you will, that you can remember of that?
Well, of course, the one that I remember most is the ditching that I had off the Indochina coast, which now they call Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There was six aircraft that went out on the mission, and we were to the targets. We would look for shipping or railroads or convoys, and three of the planes went south, and I took the other two aircraft north. And on one of the strafing runs that I made, all of a sudden, I happened to see my oil pressure was dropping dramatically, and I looked out, and there was oil streaming out from one of the engines. So they had briefed us the night before not to be a hero and try to come back to the Linh Gaen, not to Linh Gaen, to the San Marcellino airstrip.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had briefed us to head for the Parasol Islands. The Triton Reef is in particular. So I immediately asked my navigator to give me a heading, which he did immediately, and we headed in that area. It was sort of northeast of where we were. It was about 45 minutes later, we came across the reefs, and I kind of surveyed the area.
Now, something tells me you had never landed on a reef before, right?
Of course not. you don't do a ditching for it's a one-time shot because you destroy the aircraft, of course. But anyway, circled the area, found the side that the water seemed to be a little smoother, made a normal a landing as they had told us to do, and from what the aircraft that were above me said, it looked like a PBY landing in the water because it was spraying water off the lower part of the aircraft. And, of course, once it finally stalled out, it plunged into the water. We had the top hatch off, and water just blew over the top, and I thought we were drowning. And it bobbed back up and scraped on a reef, and it came to an abrupt stop with the wings out of the water. So my co-pilot, of course, he was injured. He had his hand up on the cowling. He snapped a vertebrae in his neck. The radio man forgot to remove the hatch on the side. He dove at it and clonked his head, cut his head pretty badly. But the rest of us seemed to have survived. We got bumps and bruises. One of the wingmen went up to about 6,000 feet and started sending out coordinates where we were down. In Morse code, the PBM Mariner that I was out looking for a crew that had gone down the day before couldn't find them, and they thought, well, let's go look for these other fellows. That's what they were talking about. Well, about just about dusk, here this aircraft came over the horizon. We didn't know whether it was enemy or whether it was friendly. All of a sudden, I saw the gull wings, and I knew it was a PBM Mariner. So we began shooting our very pistols. They came over to the site, and of course, they didn't know who we were either, and they circled around for a while and finally landed, and we paddled out in our life rafts, got aboard, and they brought us back to the Lingan Gulf. They ran us over to the seaplane tender, which had the doctor in the dispensary. He checked us out, patched us up, did what he could, gave us all new clothing, Navy clothing, of course.
Well, of course. And did they give you a hard time about losing the plane?
Oh, of course not. But you know, the interesting part about it, we carried 45 pistols. All those people wanted our 45s, and they would exchange them for their 38s. Can you believe that? Anyway.
The grass is always greener in the other holster.
Anyway, the following day, my squadron, two of the aircraft flew out to the see if they could find us. We were gone. The plane has apparently high tide had washed off into the deep water. And they thought we were gone, so they started packing up all our stuff to ship home. About 3 days later, they found out from the Navy that we'd been rescued, so they came up and got us. Anyway, it was a long story. We were very lucky. My navigator became an ordained Catholic priest. He came out to visit us one time, and we'd had a few snorts out by the pool, and I finally got enough courage to ask him whether he'd made a promise to become a priest if we survived the ditching, and he just roared. But to this day, I think there was some divine intervention.
Well, it's hard to imagine that there wasn't. Let's go back through that a little bit, and you tell that story so well. I do have a few questions. First of all, I'm curious, what's going through your mind as you prepare to take down this B-25 in the open water, something you've never had a chance to practice before? I imagine there's a lot of praying going on in those moments.
Well, there's, but you've got a task to do. You're so busy, you don't have time to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. I to this day, I just can't believe that we got out of that aircraft. It's really a miracle. Well, I sometimes think there was some divine intervention.
Well, and I'm sure even though you don't have time to think much, there's got to be something somewhere in your mind saying, I might die right here. This could be it.
Yeah, you just don't have time to think about that.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. But so, Ed, so what are the odds, do you think? First of all, you make the perfect water landing and skim across the top of the water. But second of all, to hit a submerged reef that you have no idea is there that gives you the chance to get out of the airplane, that's pretty much a one in a million shot too, isn't it?
That's right, because so many of our crews that ditched in the open sea were lost. They didn't even get out of the aircraft. It's unbelievable. And we had one aircraft that, of course, went down in near a enemy territory, a PBY, which is a smaller aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
He picked up the survivors, and they were shooting at him from shore and got out of there. It was unbelievable. But we lost so many people that were shot down in the ocean. It just... And I think that's why they briefed us on this Triton Reef, so that if we did get into trouble, at least it'd be a place that they could spot.
Well, but and you gave us the big picture version of it, that the other crew that was searching for someone else heard the heading that your wingmen gave out, and so they circled around and found you on that reef.
Yeah.
But when you're out on the reef, you're out of the plane, you're wounded, you're banged up, nobody knows what happened. And at that point, you have no idea how long you're going to be there, right? I mean, that has to go through your mind. When, if ever, is anyone ever going to find us?
Exactly. We were thinking about that. One of the, my first thought is how much water do we have, you know, if we're going to be here for a few days. One of the problems was I think that we would have floated away because at high tide, that reef would have been completely submerged. And so many of our crews in those rafts, you get so many squalls over in the South Pacific. You flip out of your raft, you know, there's nothing they can do. We lost so many crews that way. You'd find we'd go out on rescue missions looking for somebody that might have been shot down the day before, or the, and you'd find a raft, but nobody around.
So many variables there had to be just right, and I guess this really is one of those cases where timing really is everything?
That's right. It's a matter of timing.
And after that, a lot of people would hope, well, I hope I don't have to go up and fly again and risk this happening again because I don't expect to beat those odds a second time. But you weren't done flying, were you?
No, I wasn't done flying. In fact, actually, they wanted to send us home, and I said, well, gee, I haven't finished my missions, and I don't want to leave my buddies behind. So I went out on a I took one of the new pilots out on a training mission, and we were dropping 100-pound bombs off of an old hulk off the coast of San Marcelino. And apparently one of them ricocheted off the bottom of the, on the deck, on this deck, and ricocheted up underneath us and must have exploded and thrown shrapnel up into our hydraulic lines, because I didn't know anything had happened until I got back to the airstrip and went to put my gear down. It wouldn't come down.
So you shot out your own landing gear.
I shot out my own landing gear. Anyway, circled the airfield for a while, and they, the North American man got up in the tower, and he was trying to tell me what to do and what not to do. So they finally said, well, you want to bail out, or you want to set it down alongside the runway? I said, I think we'll set alongside the runway, which was a lot better. And I have, they took 16, the intelligence officer took film of that, a 16-millimeter camera. And many years later, at one of the reunions, he said, John, I'm going to be showing you wheels up landing at San Marcelino. I said, my God, I didn't even know you had that. So he said, I'll do something with it, make a copy of it for you. Well, about 6 months later, he called up and said, I'm going to transfer that to a VHS or beta for you, and I'll have it narrated. That's what he did. It's only a 3 or 4 minute.
Wow, I'd love to see that video sometime. And when you watch that now, and that's a luxury most guys don't have with these intense experiences of the war. Many guys can't look back at a piece of film and see what it actually looked like. When you watch that wheels up landing, do you critique yourself? Do you say, boy, was I fortunate? What do you say?
That's right. You say you got away with it again.
And how hairy was it this time? Was it a bumpy landing?
It wasn't as bad. And, you know, it's amazing. When we came back from a mission, we'd dive our B-25s at the end of the runway. We'd peel off, throw the wheels out, put our flaps down, and land. And of all the damn things to do, I should have gone out and made a nice, soft approach and landed alongside the runway. I did the same thing as I would have done if I'd come back from the mission. They couldn't believe it.
That's some pretty good calm and poise under pressure to be able to just stick to the routine. They must have really been impressed by that.
Well, anyway, when I was circling the field, I looked down, because I did this for about an hour. We played around with the gear and
trying to get it to work.
I looked down at the airfield, and it looked like the country had moved into the air. Everybody wanted to see this wheels up landing.
They wanted to see if you'd actually make it or not, huh?
Of course, actually, it was not that very serious plane. I threw the switches off and feathered the props before we hit, and it just skidded along. It wasn't very very much of a shock.
Did you exit to applause?
What's that?
Did you exit to applause from everyone who had gathered to watch?
Well, my crew chief came running over and gave me the biggest bear hug you ever saw. I said, I'm sorry, I just ruined your airplane.
Well, I think everyone knows why everyone was happy, that it was just the airplane that got ruined. We need to take our final commercial break, but John, I know you've got a few more stories, and I'm going to squeeze them out of you when we come back. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That'll get your toes tapping. String of Pearls from the late, great Glenn Miller. That's the kind of music you'll probably hear at Eagle Field this weekend. More information about Eagle Field at eaglefield.net or link at our website, kmjnow.com. Our guest today not only was at Eagle Field during World War II training, he has been there a few times since and is part of the festivities this weekend. John Beta will be 90 years old in August. Still has those crystal clear memories from his 50 missions in a B-25. You just heard him talk about ditching his B-25 and surviving against incredible odds. That mission earned him a Distinguished Flying Cross, among many other decorations, and a proud Army Air Corps career. And let's get back to those days more than 65 years ago, John. You returned to action after that, flew with your crew again, obviously in a different airplane. You told us about that other wheels-up landing you had to make. But as the war kept drawing on, did you start to get a sense that it was going to come to an end, that the United States and the Allies would be victorious and that someday you'd get to come back home?
Well, I felt that eventually I would be going home. They were, of course, we had moved from Clark Field up to Aoshima, which was an island just off the coast of Okinawa.
Right.
Ernie Pyle was killed there.
That's right.
Sniper got fired, and he was shot. But anyway, they were bringing up Marines and Army personnel and Navy personnel into Okinawa so that eventually, you know, the mainland of Japan was going to be the next target. We'd moved just about as far north as we could. I was still flying missions off of Aoshima. I had gone up as an instructor over to Okinawa for about a month because the B-25 group that was there had been glide bombing, and what I mean by that, from about 6,000 feet, the lead plane would drop their bombs and the other planes would follow suit, so they only had to have one bombardier. As an instructor, I was to teach them about strafing, and they treated us like we were we had leprosy. They didn't like that strafing at all because they've been dropping bombs at about 6,000 feet. But anyway, I was over there for about a month, and the CAO came over and got me one day and said, "John, I need you to lead the bomb group. So can you get away soon?" And I said, "I can go over this afternoon if you want, because they don't like us over here." Anyway, and this was getting along early part of August. Of course, you know, shortly after that, they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after that, the bomb on Nagasaki. And the war came to an abrupt stop. Our bomb group was selected to meet the envoys. Japanese painted two Betty bombers with green crosses on them, and we were supposed to rendezvous with them, and they were to fly to Aoshima, and then from there they were escorted. They were transferred to a C-47. It was a C-54, and flown down to Manila, where they started the first of their surrender, you know, the negotiations.
Right.
The following day, they came back, and one of the Betty bombers had damaged one of the struts on the gear, so it remained, and the other one was escorted back towards Japan, and they let it go. But that one, they forgot to refuel it. They had to ditch that aircraft on the coastline. Now, can you imagine what would have happened if that plane had gone off into the deep water and with all the negotiations on board?
It was carrying the Japanese dignitaries who were negotiating the surrender?
Right.
Wow.
The following day, the next one, they repaired the gear and they took off. So anyway, Hiroshima was off limits. And one day I was out on a rescue mission. We were looking for crews that might have been down in the water. And I got off a little course, off course a little bit, and went by Hiroshima. Some people call it Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. Terrain was just scored. It was in sort of a bowl. Sides of the mountains were scored. There wasn't any buildings left except something that was in concrete or the concrete bridges, but everything was just gone. It looked like it just burned. So I'm sure those people, when that bomb was dropped, they died instantly. You know, they've just vaporized is what happened.
Now, you said you got off course a little bit. Did curiosity take you off course, or was it a
right, the curiosity took me off course.
So you wanted to see this historic event and what it looked like.
Right.
And when you saw that, what did it do anything to you emotionally to realize that there was something capable of that kind of destruction?
Oh, I just couldn't believe it. Because we had heard it was a bomb that was, you know, thousands of times stronger than any bomb that we had in our arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's devastating to think that you're out there being shot, killed, and you're also killing human life. And it was devastating to me to see that. I realized that people had vaporized and a lot of people were going to be burned for the rest of their life.
No question. But you also talked about seeing the troop buildup on Aoshima and Okinawa and knowing that an invasion of mainland Japan was going to cost infinitely more lives on both sides. Is that the way you feel?
It would have been a terrible thing because the Japanese would not surrender. They look at the kamikaze people. They would fly into a ship.
There was no honor unless they fought to the death. That was the culture.
That's the way it was going to be when we attacked the mainland, and it was going to be just a devastating scene on both sides.
Well, John, we've only got a couple minutes left in the program here. I'm curious, when you finally did get back home to the States, what was that like for you? And is there anything else in the brief moments we have left that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, it was a great experience. I'll never forget some of the events. It was nice to get back home and with the family, and my life started again. Of course, when I got what happened, my orders had been sent in to be been cut to be sent home. What happened? All the clerical staff in the bomb groups and whatnot, the 5th Bomber Command, they were the first to be sent home. So my orders to come home got thrown in a wastebasket, into a basket somewhere, and they couldn't find them. So the war ended in August, and I didn't get back to the States until the day before Christmas. We pulled they couldn't find anybody to bring the ship into San Francisco because they have to have a pilot aboard the ship to get it into the harbor. So we floated out near the Farallon Islands until the next day. But the first thing that happened, I got off the ship the next day, and the first thing I was tagged by an MP, and he said, "Sir, you're out of uniform." I had my flight jacket on. That was my first reception to the United States again.
Welcome home.
Welcome home. And I told him, if you can find me a nice warm jacket, I'll take this off. He walked away, and anyway, so we went off to the restaurant and had a good time. I had since I was a captain, I had a whole contingent of personnel that came back aboard the ship. I had all their orders and whatnot to be returned back to the States. So anyway, when I returned to the States, I went back to college, and finally wound up flying a desk instead of an aircraft.
Flying a desk. Well, they don't get shot up as much as aircraft do.
Of course not.
Well, John, I'm so appreciative of your taking the time to share some of those stories with us. Hope you have a terrific time at Eagle Field. And thank you so much for serving our country and for sharing a little taste of it with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. I really enjoyed this.
Likewise. Pleasure's been all mine. That's John Beta of Sacramento, our guest today. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon here on Hometown Heroes, News Talk 580 KMJ.